Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 4th, 2022 Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy. Today I'll be reading the following main articles: The State of Dining Out by Josie Sexton of the Denver Post, Hundreds Attend Rally Back Superintendent by Kieran Nicholson of the Denver Post, Islamic State Leader Killed by Gaith Al-Sayed, Lolita C. Baldor, Bassem Moreau, and Zeke Miller of the Associated Press, and U.S. Intel Shows Russia Plotting False Flag Attack by Amer Madani, Lauren Cook, and Suzanne Fraser of the Associated Press. I'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. Our lead story, I don't know where it's going to end. The State of Dining Out. Denver restaurants are raising prices, slashing hours, or closing altogether. By Josie Sexton. Frank McLaughlin didn't see a way through the third year of the pandemic when he closed his 18-year-old restaurant, the Irish Snug, after one last service on January 23rd. The first and last of McLaughlin's four pubs in Denver, the Snug opened on East Colfax shortly before St. Patrick's Day in 2004. By 2020, it had become a fixture in the neighborhood, hosting weekly music sessions and comedy nights. A restaurant is a wonderful place when it's buzzing and there's people in it and there's banter, McLaughlin said Friday as he walked around the emptying space. But when it's quiet, you can hear it. It's hollow. Closed for good last month, the once buzzing Irish Snug had become a shell of its former self by 2022. A majority of the restaurant's tables sat empty most days on the lower level. Seasonal stopgaps of outdoor heaters and to-go meals just weren't enough to save it. In the good times, we're a pub, McLaughlin explained. People come in for a beer, stay for a few hours, hang around, watch the game, and meet a few people. Now there's still people taking the risk to go out and dine, but they're not going out to have beers and meet people. A January survey of more than 4,000 restaurant owners tells a similar story for dining and drinking establishments around the state. According to the Colorado Restaurant Association, 75% of operators say their customer traffic still has not reached pre-pandemic levels. Nearly 80% of operators say business conditions have worsened over the past 3 months, and 85% say they've seen a decline in sit-down customers in the past few weeks. I don't know where it's going to end, McLaughlin said. While most restaurants aren't closing for good, many are closing temporarily to weather new variants and outbreaks among staff members. After getting through the first Omicron wave in December, Christopher Lynn and his small team at Q House had to shutter the business for a full week of service in mid-January. We're running as a skeleton crew, with just enough cooks to open the restaurant in whatever capacity we can, Lynn said. And then we did get hit with two positive COVID tests on our staff, specifically the kitchen staff, so it was impossible to operate. With about 80% of his pre-pandemic workforce on the clock these days, Lynn had decided to cut back from 6 to 5 nights a week of dinner service. We can basically run the same crew all 5 days, he said, but that also means, at least on the kitchen side, that if anyone is out, we're running with a very bare crew, or if two people are out, we can't work at all. Lynn says he's thankful just to have made it through 2 years of the pandemic with the help of 2 rounds of paycheck protection and customer support for dine-in and takeout. Comparatively, a 5-night closure isn't that bad. We feel pretty lucky about it, Lynn said, because people still want to come and eat our food. Lynn has seen continued customer support even after he raised menu prices to reflect increases in Denver's minimum wage, most recently on January 1st, as well as the rising cost of food. But McLaughlin didn't want to risk pushing customers away by increasing his prices. People come to a pub to have a beer, hang out, and have an inexpensive bite to eat, McLaughlin said. I think if we were to charge $20 for a burger, it just wouldn't work for us. Both restaurateurs saw their cost of ingredients, from proteins to produce, go up by at least 50% over the last year and a half, without any correction. Food from mixed greens to pork and chicken has increased in price, they say. The cost of chicken wings went from $2.75 per pound at the start of the pandemic to $4.25 per pound now, according to McLaughlin. Nobody wants to spend $15 or whatever to buy wings, he said, so places have stopped selling them. At Jenna Ray's Wings and More, Gerard Dickerson is getting ready to increase menu prices by another 75 cents to a dollar for the second time since the start of the pandemic. When the shop first opened in 2016 in Whittier, Gerard and his father, Jen, sold a half dozen wings for $7. Now they're charging $9. We haven't really gotten any complaints per se, Gerard explained, but customers make that face. Golly, $10 just for 6 wings? We've been open for 5 years, and 3 out of the 5, we were kind of selling ourselves short. He hopes higher menu prices will help the business grow long term. For now, though, the Dickersons are sticking to the basics, replacing broken equipment and hiring employees so Gerard can spend more time at home with his 3-year-old son. This could be the bungee cord that catapults us to get to Cherry Creek, Gerard said of Dreams for a second location. They say if a restaurant can last 5 years, it's nothing but up from here. Business owners should remain hopeful about the future of their restaurants, but what about their employees? Half of our staff didn't come back, McLaughlin said of the Irish Snug, over the last year and a half in business. I think people are nervous, he said. In November, 4.5 million U.S. workers quit their jobs, with 1 million of them leaving work in the hospitality sector, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. The rate of attrition among restaurant and hotel workers at the end of 2021 was more than double the average rate across industries, 6.9% compared to 3%. That difference could be attributed to lower wages within the restaurant industry. It also can be explained by burnout. After 12 years working in restaurants, primarily as a bartender, Chotip Nimla left the industry in January for a fresh start teaching yoga. The 30-year-old had relocated from New York to Colorado with her partner, who is a chef. And while they found restaurant jobs upon moving, Nimla Orr started planning for a larger transition. I'm not old by any means, but I was getting older, and I realized how valuable my time was, she said of her outlook on working soon after the pandemic began. I was working close to 60 or 70 hour weeks as non-management, and that was just normal. The gap between my health and my career started to become bigger and bigger. While taking forced time off during the 2020 shutdown, I had this time to relax, actually relax, get a full night of sleep, eat 3 meals, go to the bathroom when I needed to go. It sounds crazy now, Nimla Orr recalls, but she sees how a culture built entirely around work and money can be really harmful. I've definitely modeled a lot of my life until now on salary, Nimla Orr said, but the scales are balanced for me now. My mental health is in a much better place, by hundreds of percentages, and I feel like my wealth has changed. I feel affluent and successful despite not having boatloads of money. It's a balance some will find within the restaurant industry, while others will look somewhere else. As he closed up the Snug last week, McLaughlin wondered when the cost of going out to eat would adjust, or whether dining out for Americans would become a special treat rather than a near daily habit. In the meantime, he gave away the kitchen's remaining food to friends still in the business and tidied up 18 years of accumulated stuff to leave the restaurant spick and span for his landlord. That's the great thing about America, McLaughlin said. Somebody will see this space and say it's a great space, and I just need to leave it clean for them. Douglas County Schools. Hundreds attend rally back superintendent. By Karen Nicholson. About 1,000 people, teachers, students, parents, and supporters, gathered in Castle Rock on Thursday afternoon for a rally to support the Douglas County School District superintendent and to demand transparency and due process by the district's board. The demonstrators lined Wilcox Street from 6th to 7th Streets in front of the district's central administration building, and many drivers passing by honked their horns, with some passengers flashing supportive signs, as the crowd waved and chanted under sunny skies, but with snow on the ground and the temperature hovering around 20 degrees. This school board made some really poor decisions and broke the law, said Matt Turnus, a math teacher at Castleview High School. We're here to demonstrate that they can't break the law without our teachers standing up to them. On Monday, three board members, Elizabeth Hansen, Susan Meek, and David Ray, said in a Zoom meeting that the president and vice president of the board, Mike Peterson and Christy Williams, respectively, had given an ultimatum to Superintendent Corey Wise to resign or be voted out. A backlash ensued, and hundreds of teachers and other staff members took Thursday off. The district canceled classes, and the rally was on. Teachers need to be heard, said Dana Diedrich, a second-grade teacher at the Renaissance School in Castle Rock. The school board makes decisions contrary to what the majority of teachers are looking for. Hours after the rally, the school district announced a special meeting at 5 p.m. Friday to discuss recent events and their impact on district leadership and operations, then go into executive or closed session followed by public consideration of the superintendent contract and the future direction of the district according to the agenda. On Thursday afternoon, many at the rally carried signs and voiced their support for Weiss's leadership. We want a voice at the table, Diedrich said. We know what's working and we know what students need. Last week, the district's board voted to change the district's equity policy, citing legitimate questions raised by school employees and parents regarding its assumptions and implementation. A sign at the rally on Thursday read, "Equity over darkness." Other signs read, "We teach kids integrity and honesty matters." In recent years, the district has been a political tempest with deep divisions about COVID-19 masks and vaccinations for students and teachers. M.J. Anton, 57, who described himself as a conservative, said that he attended the rally, taking a day off from work at Amazon to support his wife, a special education teacher in the district. Most important to me are the students and the future students, Anton said. We have to support teachers. If we lose good teachers, what happens to our students? Many people in the bundled-up crowd carried coffee cups, taking sips to try to keep warm. Some people brought their dogs to the demonstration. Children, students with a day off from school, made snow angels on the front lawn of the district property. I respect teachers and want to help them to feel appreciated, said Audra Marriott, a ninth grader at Thunder Ridge High School in Highlands Ranch. Marriott attended the rally with her sister Claire, a seventh grader from Cloverleaf Enrichment School, and with their mom, Christina. The new board doesn't respect teachers, Claire said. Mary Margaret, a parent of two high school students and a former Douglas County teacher who now teaches in another district, said she took a day off to support teachers and attend. I watched this district deteriorate over politics, Margaret said. Outside money has been brought in, and people are trying to destroy the school district here. And this from the Associated Press. U.S. raid in Syria. Islamic State leader killed. During the attack, al-Qurashi blew himself up and his family. Dateline, Atma, Syria. The leader of the Islamic State blew himself up along with members of his family as American forces raided his Syrian hideout Thursday, the U.S. said. The second time in 3 years, the United States has taken out a leader of the violent group that has been struggling for resurgence with deadly attacks in the region. President Joe Biden announced the overnight raid by American Special Operations Forces, which U.S. officials called a significant blow to the radical militant organization. The Islamic State, at the height of its power, controlled more than 40,000 square miles stretching from Syria to Iraq and ruled over 8 million people. Its attacks in the region included a major assault last month to seize a prison in northeast Syria, holding at least 3,000 Islamic State detainees. The raid targeted Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qurashi, who took over as head of the group on October 31, 2019, just days after Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi died during a U.S. raid. Al-Qurashi, unlike his predecessor, was far from a household name, a secretive man who presided over a far diminished version of the group and did not appear in public. Biden said al-Qurashi died, as al-Baghdadi did, by exploding a bomb that killed himself and members of his family, including women and children, as U.S. forces approached. Thanks to the bravery of our troops, this horrible terrorist leader is no more, Biden said at the White House. He said al-Qurashi had been responsible for last month's prison assault in Hasaka, as well as genocide against the Yazidi people in Iraq in 2014. About 50 U.S. Special Operations Forces landed in helicopters and attacked a house in a rebel-held corner of Syria, clashing for 2 hours with gunmen, witnesses said. Residents described continuous gunfire and explosions that jolted the town of Atma, near the Turkish border, an area dotted with camps for internally displaced people from Syria's civil war. Biden said he ordered U.S. forces to take every precaution available to minimize civilian casualties, the reason they did not conduct an airstrike. First responders reported that 13 people had been killed, including 6 children and 4 women. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby said U.S. forces were able to evacuate 10 people from the building, a man, a woman, and 4 children from the first floor, and 4 children from the second floor. He said when al-Qurashi detonated the bomb, he also killed his wife and 2 children. Kirby said that U.S. officials were working to determine whether American action resulted in any civilian deaths. There were no U.S. casualties, Kirby said. U.S. forces took fingerprints and DNA, which confirmed al-Qurashi's death, he said. The raid marked a military success for the United States at an important time after setbacks elsewhere, including the chaotic Afghanistan withdrawal, had led allies and opponents to conclude U.S. power globally was weakening. Al-Qurashi had kept an extremely low profile since he took over leadership of the Islamic State. U.S. officials said that he never left his apartment except to bathe on the building's roof. It is difficult to gauge how his death will affect the group. U.S. officials claimed he was directly overseeing operations in Syria. They're leaderless today, and that's a significant blow, Kirby said. The second floor of the house was occupied by a lower-ranking Islamic State leader and his family, but the first floor contained civilians who were unconnected to the terrorist group and unaware of al-Qureshi's presence, according to U.S. officials, who described them as unwitting human shields. Biden gave the final go on the mission on Tuesday morning during his daily national security briefing in the Oval Office, where he was joined by Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley. In the first stages of the operation, residents and activists said, U.S. commandos staged a large ground assault using megaphones urging women and children to leave the area. Much to the relief of U.S. officials, the family on the first floor exited the building unharmed. The Islamic State lieutenant, who officials did not name, who lived on the second floor, barricaded himself inside along with his wife and engaged in combat with the commandos, who entered the home after the explosion. After a firefight in which both were killed, officials said four children were removed from the second floor, alive, by U.S. forces. Kirby said that it appeared that a child on the second floor also died. The special forces spent about 2 hours on the ground, longer than usual for such an operation, indicative, U.S. officials said, of caution to minimize civilian casualties. Our next front page story, also from the Associated Press, Ukraine. U.S. intel shows Russia plotting false flag attack. Dateline Washington. The U.S. accused the Kremlin on Thursday of an elaborate plot to fabricate an attack by Ukrainian forces that Russia could use as a pretext to take military action against its neighbor. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said the scheme included production of a graphic propaganda video that would show staged explosions and use corpses and actors depicting grieving mourners. However, the U.S. has not provided detailed information backing up the claims. The plan for a fake attack on Russian territory or Russian-speaking people was described in declassified intelligence shared with Ukrainian officials and European allies in recent days. It was the latest example of the Biden administration divulging intelligence findings as a tactic to attempt to stop Russian disinformation efforts and foil what it says is Russian President Vladimir Putin's effort to lay the groundwork for military action. If Russia does invade, administration officials say that they want to make clear Russia had always sought to create a pretext. In recent weeks, the White House has said that U.S. intelligence shows Russia has launched a malign social media disinformation campaign against Ukraine and has dispatched operatives trained in explosives to carry out acts of sabotage against Russia's own proxy forces. Britain has divulged intelligence findings that it says show Russia plotting to install a pro-Russian puppet government in Ukraine. We've seen these kinds of activity by the Russians in the past, and we believe it's important when we see it like this, and we can, to call it out, Kirby told reporters in the Pentagon. The administration repeatedly declined to detail evidence underlying its intelligence findings. State Department spokesman Ned Price said the administration needed to protect sensitive sources and intelligence gathering methods. He added, "We declassify information only when we're confident in that information." Meanwhile, on Thursday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan offered to mediate talks between Russia and Ukraine, and NATO warned that Moscow's military buildup continues, with more troops and military equipment deployed to neighboring Belarus than at any time in the past 30 years. Erdogan, who has close but sometimes difficult times with Putin, said Turkey was prepared to undertake its part in order to end the crisis between two friendly nations that are its neighbors in the Black Sea. "I have stressed that we would be happy to host a summit meeting at a leadership level or technical level talks," Erdogan said, after about 3 hours of talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Instead of fueling the fire, we act with the logical aim of reducing the tensions, he said. Russia has amassed more than 100,000 troops near Ukraine's northern and eastern borders, raising concern that Moscow might invade again, as it did in 2014. The troop presence and uncertainty have unnerved Ukrainians and hurt the country's economy. Russian officials deny that an invasion is planned. Zelensky welcomed Erdogan's offer and thanked him again for his firm and consistent support. The crisis has put Turkey in a fix, leaving it in a position where it has to balance its growing partnership with Ukraine with its difficult relationship with Moscow. Ankara, which has historic ties to Ukraine and ethnic bonds with its Crimean Tatar community, strongly opposed Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea. At the same time, Turkey would be reluctant to join in any sanctions against Russia. With a struggling economy, the country has pinned its hopes on tourism revenue, especially from visitors from Russia. It also relies on Russia for much of its natural gas. The U.S. said the new intelligence indicates that the Russians would stage military equipment used by Ukraine, including a key weapon supplied by Turkey, a NATO member, to bolster the credibility of a fake attack. Russia possibly would use Turkish-made Bayraktar drones as part of the fake operation, according to a senior administration official who was not authorized to comment and spoke on the condition of anonymity. The drones have been used by Ukraine against pro-Russia separatists in the Donbas region, a move that angered Moscow, which has made it clear it is strongly opposed to Ukraine being equipped with the technology. Putin and French President Emmanuel Macron spoke again Thursday, their third call in less than a week. The Kremlin said in a statement that they continued a detailed dialogue about the situation around Ukraine, and added that Putin drew Macron's attention to provocative statements and actions by the Ukrainian leadership. At NATO headquarters, Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg warned that Russian troop numbers in Belarus are likely to climb to 30,000 with the backing of special forces, advanced fighter jets, Iskander short-range ballistic missiles, and S-400 ground-to-air missile defense systems. Over the last days, we have seen a significant movement of Russian military forces into Belarus. This is the biggest Russian deployment there since the Cold War, Stoltenberg told reporters. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu was in Minsk on Thursday, checking on preparations for major Russia-Belarus war games that are scheduled through February 20th. And back in Denver, What's Being Done to Address Crime by Elise Schmelzer. Crime keeps rising in Denver, and its top public safety leaders say the solutions include improving addiction treatment, hiring more police officers to fill vacant positions, and reviewing who has to pay money to get out of jail after an arrest. Mayor Michael Hancock pledged Thursday to address the scourge of crime and released a 7-page public safety action plan that outlined how the police, fire, and sheriff's departments would make Denver safer. "I'm not going to allow this to continue to happen on my watch," Hancock said, "but I also realize this is a marathon, not a sprint." Denver's 2021 violent crime rate of 928 crimes per 100,000 residents is the highest recorded in the city since 1994, according to FBI data collected by the Denver Post. The 2021 property crime rate of 5,865 crimes per 100,000 is the highest since 2005. Data collected by the Post shows that most categories of crime in 2021 increased by more than 5% compared with 2020. Robberies, aggravated assaults, burglaries, larceny, arson, and motor vehicle theft. Per capita rates for all of those categories are also higher than the three-year average. The numbers also show the rise in many categories in 2021. I'll read that again. The numbers also show the rise slowed in many categories in 2021. For example, the rate of aggravated assault rose 23% in 2020 compared with 2019. It continued to rise in 2021, but by 7% compared with 2020. This isn't just a Denver challenge or a Denver area challenge or even a Colorado challenge, Hancock said of rising crime. It's an American challenge. Hancock said there's no single cause of the increase and thus no single solution. He pointed to a slew of potential factors, a rising number of illegal guns in the city, an influx of cheap drugs, unmet mental health needs, increasing youth violence, and a justice system that releases people from incarceration too easily after arrest. We can't solve these issues with law enforcement alone, he said. This is a multifaceted public health crisis. We can't simply arrest our way out of it. The city's plan to address crime includes expanding the number of crime hotspots that Denver police will focus on, hiring 184 police officers over the next year to fill vacant positions, creating a resource center where police can take arrestees instead of jail, expanding non-police response programs such as STAR, allowing Denver Sheriff Department deputies to investigate alleged crimes in the jail, freeing up Denver police officers who used to do those investigations, expanding the jail's medicated-assisted treatment program to treat more incarcerated people with addiction, reviewing the risk assessment tool that judges consider when setting bail, and reviewing the bail schedule, which guides how judges set bail, working with nonprofit Lifeline Colorado to create a network of youth empowerment centers that provide services to young people. Denver Police Chief Paul Pazin announced in May that officers would focus on five hotspots of concentrated crime. Those include South Federal Boulevard and West Alameda Avenue, Colfax Avenue and Broadway, East Colfax Avenue and North Yosemite Street, East 47th Avenue and North Peoria Street, and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and North Holly Street. Pazin on Thursday said there had been significant reductions in shootings in four of those five areas, and that the city would add three more hotspots to the list: West 14th Avenue and Federal Boulevard, East Dartmouth Avenue and South Havana Street, and West Mississippi Avenue and South Lipan Street. Police will also continue to focus on arresting people at Union Station. Hancock on Thursday also said bond reform, while needed, created a revolving door loophole that allows people who pose a public safety risk to return quickly to the streets after an arrest. He specifically criticized the use of personal recognizance bonds, which allow a person to leave jail while they wait for trial without paying any money. When asked, Hancock said he didn't know what percentage of people released on personal recognizance bonds reoffended while waiting for trial, and instead provided anecdotes of people released on personal recognizance bonds committing crimes. City Attorney Kristen Bronson will review the use of personal recognizance bonds and the evaluations that pretrial services use to decide how much of a safety risk a person poses. Senate President Garcia resigning for job at Pentagon by Alex Burness and Nick Coltrane. Leroy Garcia, president of the state Senate since 2019, says he is resigning his position February 23rd to take on a new one in the Federal Department of Defense. The term-limited Pueblo Democrat, who is 3 weeks into his final session as a state legislator, has long been rumored as a possible candidate for a federal post, as he is close with the administration of President Joe Biden. Garcia served as a leader of Biden's Latino Leadership Council during the president's 2020 campaign. Garcia previously served as minority leader in the Senate and served in the State House of Representatives. His new title, the Senate Democratic Caucus said, will be Special Assistant to the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Manpower and Reserve Affairs within the Department of Defense at the Pentagon. For nearly a decade, I have had the immense honor to represent the people of Pueblo at the Colorado State Capitol and the privilege to serve as Senate President since 2019, Garcia said in a written statement. I am incredibly grateful that my community and my colleagues entrusted me with this responsibility, and I have been humbled by the opportunity to serve the state I love. While my time in the Senate is coming to a close, I am proud of all that we've accomplished together to move Colorado forward, and I am confident that whomever is selected to fill these vacancies will serve with the integrity and tenacity that Coloradans deserve. Garcia's seat in the state Senate will be filled by a vacancy committee. The Senate Democratic Caucus did not immediately name a likely replacement for the role of president. Most were unaware of Garcia's new job until Thursday. Democrats control the chamber by a 20-15 margin, so it is a certainty that the next president will come from that party, and several members already appear interested. Minority Leader Chris Hulbert of Douglas County, the top Republican in the Senate, said in a statement, "I appreciate the president giving me a heads up on this announcement. That is a clear indication of how we've come to trust each other and communicate over the last 3 years as part of Senate leadership. I wish him the very best in his career and life after the General Assembly." House Speaker Alec Garnett, a Denver Democrat, said Leroy's life has been devoted to service, and he's going to take Colorado's voice to Washington, which is a good thing. Added Democratic Governor Jared Polis, "On behalf of a grateful state, I congratulate him on his appointment." Garcia, who served in the Marines and is a trained and still practicing first responder in Pueblo, has been known as a hands-off leader who generally does not interfere with his members' policy pursuits. He's been a reliably liberal vote for the caucus, although notably stood apart from his colleagues by voting in 2019 against a red flag gun bill that allows courts to order firearms seized from people deemed dangerous to themselves or others. But now and then, Garcia did champion big or controversial changes, including in 2020, when he helped lead landmark police reform legislation that was inspired by Black Lives Matter protests in the wake of the killing of George Floyd by police in Minnesota. In addition to the rumors that Garcia might one day take a federal position, he has for years been rumored as a potential congressional candidate. He passed on running for Colorado's 3rd congressional district in 2020 when Republican U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert won the seat. COVID-19. Keep those masks on, Colorado health officials say, by Jessica Seaman. Colorado public health officials continue to express cautious optimism Thursday at COVID-19's downward trajectory in the state, but said transmission of the virus remains high enough that people should continue wearing masks indoors, even as metro counties lift their mandates. The state is emerging from its worst surge yet of new infections, one that outpaced the winter wave in 2020, and case rates remain at their highest levels since that deadly phase a year ago. While things are moving in the right direction, there's still a lot of COVID-19 that is circulating in our community right now, said Dr. Rachel Herlihy, state epidemiologist, during a news briefing. The highly contagious Omicron variant is spreading widely in the state, and three cases of its subvariant, BA2, have been detected in Colorado, Herlihy said. An estimated 1 in 19 Coloradans is infected with the virus, according to the most recent report by the state's modeling team. Deaths from the virus began increasing again in early January after a decline after the Delta variant surge. But the good news is that cases are declining, and so is the number of people hospitalized with the virus. On Thursday, 1,162 people were hospitalized, which is down from 1,195 patients the day before, according to the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Colorado's Combined Hospital Transfer Center, which helps facilitate transfer of patients when they're, which helps facilities transfer patients when their beds are full, is moving to its second activation level, Tier 2, this week. The center has operated at its highest level, Tier 3, since November. At this second level, the center will focus on moving patients between smaller hospitals and larger medical centers, rather than across the entire state, according to the news release. Both Herlihy and Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander, encouraged Coloradans to keep wearing masks indoors, staying home and getting tested when they are sick, and getting vaccinated against the virus. Despite high levels of disease transmission, Denver, Arapahoe, and Adams counties on Monday announced that they will lift their mask mandates for businesses and indoor public spaces at the end of this week. Jefferson County public health officials took similar action on Thursday, agreeing to lift that county's mask order for businesses and schools on February 18th. Everything is going in the right direction, Jeffco Health Board member Sherry Jansaid of COVID-19 said of COVID-19 case numbers, hospitalizations, and deaths. The counties are making the right decisions for the communities, Bookman said, adding, there's a very big difference between a mandate and a continued recommendation to wear masks indoors. He acknowledged the toll the months-long surge has taken on the state's health care workers, but said cautious optimism is certainly where we are. We have a long way to come down from where we have been, and we want to ensure that every Coloradan is as protected as they can be as we move out of this wave, he said. Also on page 2 of today's Denver Post is a photo from Jenny Sparks of the Reporter Herald with the headline, Valentine's Time in Loveland. And the caption says, Miss Loveland Valentine Olivia Frisk chats with members of the Four The Good Times Barbershop Quartet on Monday during the kickoff to the 76th Loveland Valentine Remailing Program. The first Valentine with a Loveland postmark went to Australia. The local post office handled more than 100,000 Valentines in 2021. You can still drop off Valentines for delivery within the continental U.S. until Monday. All letters being sent within the state or to Wyoming must be dropped off by Wednesday. Possible election security protocol breach. Third Colorado County Clerk under investigation by Saja Hindi. A third Colorado County Clerk and recorder is now under investigation by the Secretary of State's office over allegations of potentially breaching election security protocols. An October 1, 2021 telegram message from Ash in America and forwarded from Don W. was attributed to Douglas County Clerk and Recorder Merlin Klotz, a Republican. It stated that a copy of the voting equipment server was created, according to the message provided by Democratic Secretary of State Jenna Griswold's office. When Griswold's office was alerted to the post attributed to Klotz on January 28th, The department asked Klotz to submit more information by January 31st, but he did not respond, her office said. So she issued an order Thursday requiring that the information be disclosed by February 10th in writing about how the image was made, who was involved, and who else knew about it. She also ordered that video surveillance of voting equipment be turned on and that no one enter the equipment room unaccompanied. To ensure the security of Douglas County's voting equipment, I am issuing an election order requiring the Douglas clerk to disclose information regarding the imaging of the election equipment server, Griswold said in a written statement. As Secretary of State, I will continue to protect Colorado's election infrastructure to ensure that every eligible Coloradan, Republican, Democrat, and Independent alike, has access to secure elections. Klotz is one of the plaintiffs who sued Griswold's office in November in an attempt to launch an Arizona-style audit of the 2020 election results. He did not immediately respond to requests for comment on Thursday. After my friend SOS, Wayne Williams, selected Dominion as the sole election system provider for Colorado, I sued for an alternative. Accordingly, only Douglas and Garfield counties now use clear ballot election system, the telegram message read. And we, as always, took a full image backup of our server before a trusted build was done this year. A conspiracy theory involving Dominion voting systems is often cited among supporters of former President Donald Trump, who claim without evidence widespread election fraud during the 2020 election, claims that have been repeatedly debunked. All other counties in Colorado use Dominion voting systems, and San Juan uses Dominion for ballot marking devices and then hand counts without a scanner and tabulation, according to the Secretary of State's office. The message noted that Klotz was in communication with the Lindell legal team. Mike Lindell is the CEO of MyPillow and a 2020 election conspiracy theorist. It also referenced Mesa County Clerk and Recorder Tina Peters, saying that before Peters exposing what was going on with the trusted build process, a routine update to protect against vulnerabilities, according to the Secretary of State's office, Klotz assumed it was just an update to newer program files. A grand jury is investigating Peters and others in relation to allegations of election equipment tampering and official misconduct. She is the first Colorado County clerk to be investigated by Griswold's office over allegedly allowing an unauthorized man access to a secure area in the county elections office. Passwords from voting equipment were later posted online, according to the Secretary of State's office. Peters was also barred by a judge from overseeing the 2021 election, and the Secretary of State's office is seeking a similar outcome for 2022. Earlier this month, Griswold ordered Elbert County Clerk and Recorder Dallas Schroeder to appear at a deposition and answer questions about allegedly making a copy of the Dominion Voting System's hard drive, with direction from others outside his office. Schroeder is also part of the lawsuit against the Secretary of State's office. Like in the case of Elbert County, Griswold's office said it didn't believe that the alleged unauthorized imaging in Douglas County has created an imminent or direct security risk to Colorado's elections, because it's said to have occurred prior to the 2021 trusted build of the county's voting equipment. I will now go over the basics from some of the, well, all of the obituaries in today's Denver Post. Jill Louise Bear, born June 28, 1942, and died on January 17, 2022, at the age of 79. She was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In August 1965, Jill married her husband of over 55 years, Ernst Herbert Bear. They settled in Denver, Colorado for more than 51 years. Jill worked in advertising, marketing, sales, and public relations. Jill is survived by her husband, Ernst, as well as their three children, Corrine, Brandt, and Kristen, dedicated sons-in-law, Sanford Summer and Benjamin Auten, loving daughter-in-law, Jamie Bear, her eight cherished grandchildren, Cecilia, William, and Charles Summer, Emily Maxwell and Eric Bear, Bear and River Auten, her sister and brother-in-law, Dorothy and Anthony DiMarino Jr., and their larger family. She was preceded in death by her parents, Herbert and Dorothy, and her younger brother, Charles Jr. A public memorial service followed by reception will be held at 1 p.m. on February 5th at Horan and McConaty on County Line Road in Centennial. Live stream for the service will be offered. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to either Cure PSP or to the Denver Center for the Performing Arts in memory of Jill Bear. Cure PSP donations will support education, research, and hopefully cure for the extremely rare neurodegenerative disease that Jill endured in her final years. Marcus Andrew Hyde, 32, passed away January 20th, 2022. Please visit monarchsociety.com for full obituary. William Randall Randy Parks, born January 15, 1962, and died January 19, 2022. He was from Colorado Springs, and he died suddenly of medical complications in his home. The funeral service will be held at noon February 7th at Swan Law Funeral Home in Colorado Springs, and you can attend virtually at mudnuts1962.com. Maxine Scooball, born September 2, 1936 and died January 23, 2022. She was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin and passed away peacefully in her sleep. She is preceded in death by her husband, Thomas G. Scooball, but survived by her three sons, Michael of Pewaukee, Wisconsin, James of Hartford, Wisconsin, and Thomas of Littleton, Colorado, along with her seven grandchildren and eight great-grandchildren. For more information, visit cfcscolorado.org/obituaries. Phyllis Swanson, born July 1930 and died January 29, 2022 at the age of 91. She was from Westminster, Colorado, but was born in Wagon Mound, New Mexico. She was the oldest of eight siblings and is predeceased by her parents, Jose and Sylvia, two sisters and three brothers, Emily, Geneva, Eddie, Ronald, and Raymond. She is survived by a brother, Joe, of Colorado Springs, and a sister, Marie, of Malabar, Florida. She married Ernest Sena in 1951 and shortly after moved to the Denver area. She and Ernest had three children, Yvonne, Vivian, and Arnold. In 1984, she was divorced from Ernest and later married Will Swanson in 1990. Both Ernest and Will predeceased her. She is survived by daughter Yvonne, daughter Vivian, and son Arnold. She had three grandchildren, Jason, Desi, and Ayrton, and two great-grandchildren, Ellie and Avery. No formal service is currently planned. A private family celebration of her life will be held at a later date. Returning to news, how to prevent early birth. Study explores sugarless gum. Healthy mouth, healthy baby. For years, scientists have been exploring the link between poor oral health and giving birth too early. Now, new research presented Thursday raises the possibility that something very simple and inexpensive might make a difference, chewing sugarless gum. The improvements seen in the study in the African country of Malawi were modest. The rates of premature birth were slightly lower in the pregnant women who chewed the gum compared to those who did not. Still, experts welcome the idea of an easy way to attack this huge and costly problem. While gum is cheap, an early birth can lead to a host of health problems in babies and tens of thousands of dollars in medical costs. If we could find an intervention as simple as chewing gum to stop preterm births, I would be absolutely elated, said Dr. Zakiba Henderson of the March of Dimes, adding that she's guardedly optimistic about the findings. For many years, studies have shown that gum diseases are tied to premature birth. Scientists believe bacterial infections in the mouth can increase inflammation in the body, which could lead to early birth. Researchers tested whether chewing gum made with the sweetener xylitol could help. Xylitol is a sugar substitute found in small amounts in fruits and vegetables. It has been shown in past research to gradually change the makeup of bacteria in the mouth so that fewer decay-causing bacteria survive on tooth surfaces and less plaque forms. Plaque buildup can lead to gum disease. The study in Malawi enrolled more than 10,000 women over 6 years. Some joined before they got pregnant, others in the first half of their pregnancy. At 4 centers, participants received oral health education and chewed the gum twice daily. At 4 others, the control group received only the education. There was a lower rate of preterm births before 37 weeks in the group that chewed xylitol gum, 13% compared with 17% in the control group. The biggest difference was in late preterm births between 34 and nearly 37 weeks. Although giving birth earlier is potentially worse for the baby, experts say late preterm infants are at risk for such things as respiratory problems, feeding difficulties, and developmental issues. Other studies have suggested more traditional steps to improve oral health also help prevent preterm birth. For example, a review of clinical trials last year found that the treatment of gingivitis, which involves dental visits and cleanings, may also reduce prematurity. Thank you for joining us for the Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy.